Welcome. My name is Dean Reuter, and today I have the great pleasure of introducing Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin to you. As governor, Scott Walker has shown himself to be a man with firm convictions about the rule of law, with a keen sense of responsibility for the taxpayers' money, and a very spirited sense of resolve. He began his life in politics when he was elected to Wisconsin State Assembly in 1993. Where he served until he was elected Milwaukee's county executive in 2002. As Milwaukee County's executive for 8 years, he applied his vision of government to great effect. And as Wisconsin and other states around the country endured a period of budgetary crisis, his county did just fine, posting record surpluses. Governor Walker won his current office just 3 short years ago, and then he won it again even more recently. As governor, he's made major improvements in the areas of law enforcement, economic policy, and much more. He has championed significant civil justice reform initiatives, and he's worked hard to streamline Wisconsin's regulatory regime, all the while emphasizing fairness and transparency in the regulatory process. He's revitalized Wisconsin as a place to work and is on track to meet his goal of creating 250,000 new jobs by 2015. All of this stands against a backdrop of his push not just for smaller government, but for more restrained government. Yet, in cutting the state's $3.6 billion deficit, he hasn't compromised on core services of government, or on the quality of education his state provides. The governor has also championed the Constitution not only in Wisconsin's regular amicus participation in major constitutional cases, but also in his appointment to the Wisconsin judicial branch. And a fine example of it is his 2012 appointment of someone near and dear to our hearts, Rebecca Bradley, a former officer of the Federalist Society's Milwaukee chapter. He appointed her to the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, and now, of course, we all have to call Rebecca Your Honor. Governor Walker has proven himself to be a dedicated and deft public servant. He's a man of strong ideals and strong character. We're very pleased to welcome him here today. Governor Walker.
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks. Good morning. Thank you. It is indeed an honor to be here today. Being in this town, it reminds me of something that President Reagan said on his first day in office back in January of 1981. It's something I like to remember often, particularly as I visit our nation's capital, because it puts in perspective, I think, where we're at this time and age. And he said simply this: "We should all remember that the federal government did not create the states. The states created the federal government." And the reason I say that to begin with is often over the last year or so, as I've been in and out of this Capitol, and I like to come here, I like to go home even more. So I come briefly and then return home. But in the last year or so, as many people were frustrated with the outcome of the presidential election and of some of the Senate races and others across the country, I'm reminded of those words, and it gives me solace because I know in our state and in other key states across this country, there is a different brand of leadership happening in America. And as frustrating as it is with some of the challenges, and yet again seeing it yesterday on display here in our nation's capital, the fact of the matter is that true reform happens in the states. We're going to certainly talk about some of our legal reforms as it applies to what we call Act 10 in the state of Wisconsin. But overall, when you think about tax reform, education reform, legal reform, entitlement reform, real reforms begin and ultimately get done in the state, and eventually many of them percolate up here to Washington. In fact, if you think back to it, someone who was a good friend of mine and I was glad to serve with many years ago, Tommy Thompson, was the governor of Wisconsin back in the mid-1990s. And he and another great governor on the other side of the Great Lake, Michigan, Governor John Engler put forward welfare reform in each of our respective states, and it started there in the Midwest, and eventually, later in the mid to late 1990s, it became the law here in our federal government, precisely because it began in the states. And you see it time and time again, whether it's tax reform, other reforms out there. Reforms don't begin here. They begin in our states, in our state houses all across America. And so today I want to talk a little bit about our reforms and maybe enlighten you a little bit. And there's a good group from here from Wisconsin. I'm blessed. I won't name everybody. I'm gonna meet with a number. You can clap for Wisconsin. Sure, that's all right. It's one of those where you just heard the reference to one of my appointees, who I'm very proud to call an appointee, Judge Rebecca Bradley. I've also got my chief legal counsel here, Brian Hagedorn. I've got another key member of our cabinet, Andrew Hitt, who's here. I've got, and I'm going to discuss this in a few moments, but our judicial selection process is headed by a great former circuit court judge and a good Federalist Society member, Michael Brennan, as well. And I didn't appoint her, but I'd like to lay credit for it because I advocated for her appointment to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. She's now a federal judge, but Diane Sykes is here as well, and one of our favorite jurists. And if I ever got a chance to appoint you something in the future, I'd be inclined to do that, but I won't talk. Now, the rest of my staff just wilted with that comment, so I'm going to get questions like that. I know the rest of the day about my book, let alone adding something like that. But it's great to hear Daniel Sir, who worked the Federal Society, also works on our staff. This is a great group of folks, not only from Wisconsin, but many of whom I depend on each and every day. And I'm going to touch at the end a little bit about that and the impact that it has on our appointments to the judiciary and what it means not just to the legal society in our state, but really to the larger good. Because I'm not a lawyer. And in some audiences, that gets a round of applause when I say that. You'd be surprised. In fact, in almost every other audience, it gets a round of applause. I was actually out doing a tower hunt not long ago, which for those of you who don't hunt, that's where there's pheasants coming out of the top of a tower, and I was doing it as a fundraiser for our campaign, and someone was joking about, remember years ago when the vice president had a similar outing, and they asked, you know, why would I would do that in light of what Vice President Cheney had done, and I said, well, I took solace from hearing from Jay Leno that night on The Tonight Show. He said that Dick Cheney's approval rating had gone up to 92% when the public heard he shot his lawyer. They said, no, don't keep laughing. My wife, Tonette, would say that only encourages me to go on even further with jokes. But to get on to a serious matter, for us, it's really an honor, like I said, to be here today, and as much of an influence people have had in the state of Wisconsin who are members of the Federalist Society, it really is an honor to talk to folks from all across this country who are share the same commitment. And even though, like I mentioned, even though I'm not a lawyer, I think all of us in each of our respective states, and particularly in the country as a whole, need to share those core values that go way back to the founders of this great country, those founding principles. That whether you practice in law or not, you should abide by and understand and embrace and support, because they're key elements to our future success. It was interesting, when I took the oath of office on January 3rd of 2011, I was just in the rotunda yesterday doing an interview, and I pointed out to where the east wing of the governor's office is, or the east wing of the Capitol, I should say, is where the governor's office is, and there's a bust of a famous name in our state, Bob LaFollette, who had been well known, was in many ways kind of one of the fathers of the progressive movement. And traditionally, the governor takes the oath of office in front of the East Wing, because that's where the governor's office is. In January of 2011, I did something a little unconventional. I moved it around the corner, one wing over. It's still in the same rotunda, not so much because of Bob LaFollette, although some might argue that was a little bit of it. But mainly because in front of me, when I took the oath of office, was our state's constitution. And the reason I did that is I invoked a part of our constitution that's never been altered, never been amended. It's one of the few parts that hasn't been touched, all the way back to May of 1848. And it essentially is what we call the frugality clause. It talks about how moderation and frugality in government leads to freedom and prosperity for our people. Little did I know how prophetic those words would be just 5 or 6 weeks later when I introduced a bill that today is now called Act 10. And at the time, and people have asked me, and you got a copy there as well, I'm going to sign some books later. People asked me earlier today, why did I write a book? You know, because in this town, people write a book for one reason. That's not the reason I wrote it. The reason I wrote it is because people had a question about not only what we did in Wisconsin, but why we did it and where it came from and how we went about doing that. And that's really fundamentally what we share and how we did apply not just to collective bargaining, but to other great challenges in states all across America, in many ways to some of the challenges we face here in our nation's capital. But in our case, when we did it, it was real simple. We knew going into our biennial budget, which began in July 1st of 2011 and just wrapped up this last June 30th of 2013, we knew that if we were going to balance our budget in a way that didn't raise taxes, that didn't impose massive layoffs and didn't cut massive or provide massive cuts in things like Medicaid, in our state at least, where over half of our budget is aid to local government, the only way we could do that is if we reduced aid to local governments. And for 8 years, I was a county executive. That was effectively like the mayor of the county. And I saw the challenges that would provide for local governments all across my state if we didn't give them the tools to offset those reductions in state aid. For many, many years, I tried to do responsible, at least what I viewed to be responsible adjustments to pension and healthcare contributions, even things as simple as one point to do a series of 35-hour work weeks in our county government to try and avoid the layoffs that happened particularly during the times of the recession the last few years. And time after time after time after time again, the public employee union bosses, the big government union bosses said no. I mean, essentially what they were telling us is they would rather have people laid off than have someone mess with their benefits. And I think the reason was simple. They believed that I would be gone someday. They'd get their employees back when they elected someone new to take my place who was more in line with their philosophy. And along the way, they'd never have to give an inch on their benefits. And I knew, in turn, that was not only not a good thing for the employees who'd be laid off, but it was detrimental to the broader public, because when you do that, you have a negative impact on the policy or on the programs and services, the legitimate programs and services that the government should provide. Because I believe in limited government. I think the government, particularly here in Washington, but even at the state and the local level, is too big and too expansive, too involved in our lives. But for the government that's left, the government that's necessary, I believe it should work. Sometimes people in the media ask me if I hate government. I say, no, I hate government that's too big, and government that's left that doesn't work. And one of the things that often the media looked at, what we've done over the last 2.5 years in Wisconsin, that have gotten a little bit misguided observation about, is what we did was not about austerity. Austerity is about cutting things across the board. That was an option. We had to cut everything evenly, just to across the board sweep and take that funding and use it to balance the budget. If we'd done that at the levels, considering the $3.6 billion budget deficit we inherited, that would have been devastating, both to state and to local governments. Instead of doing austerity, what we did was about reform. And in our state, and I believe in other states and other jurisdictions, not just at the state level, but in cities all across America, why this fight is so important is because it's one of those things that's a part of that tipping point, not just in our federal government, but the tipping point in our state and our local governments as well. And that is where, not just for our generation, but for future generations, we've got to make a clear decision about which side we're going to be on. Are we going to think about the next election, or are we going to think about the next generation? In Wisconsin, we chose the next generation. And how we did that was through what we call collective bargaining reform. That's the premise of Act 10. We essentially came in and said, we're going to fundamentally change collective bargaining in the state of Wisconsin. You see, it was part of a vicious cycle. And for those of you who don't operate in the public sphere and haven't examined this, let me explain to you at least essentially how I view things when it comes to collective bargaining in the public sector. Taxpayers' money is used to fund legitimate wages and benefits for public employees. But on top of that, in addition, there's added union dues. Those union dues then go to the union not only for legitimate union activities, but on top of that, they use them for political purposes. They form political action committees that then go out and interview candidates and ask candidates a series of questions, usually behind closed doors, about things as simple as, how much more are you going to add to public benefits? How many more public employees are you going to have? How much bigger are you going to grow the government? And then in turn, they make choices about which candidates to support, essentially by how many commitments or promises they make to those political action committees or the unions. And then those unions put that money, whether in public or not, publicly disclosed or not, they put that money behind candidates who are essentially the candidates who are the ones who are going to say, when they say jump, they're going to jump the highest. And nowhere in that equation does anyone stand up and advocate for the taxpayers. Nowhere in that equation. We said somebody needed to break that cycle. Somebody needed to put the taxpayers back in charge. And it wasn't easy at first. You all saw it if you watched and tuned into the news or read the newspaper. At one point we had, in the spring of 2011, we had about 100,000 protesters in and around our state capitol. It wasn't exactly my idea of tourism, but my tourism secretary loved it. Actually, the trade-off was pretty good from a tourism standpoint. We had 100,000 visitors, and all we had to do was send 14 state senators down to Illinois. In fact, after we successfully got through Act 10 a month later, and then eventually along the way, particularly as all of our court battles, which continue today, but the first series of them were successful, I was up in northern Wisconsin where a first-term member of Congress, Sean Duffy, is a good friend of mine. He and his wife, Rachel, are great Americans. And Sean was at an event we were at in Bayfield County near the Apostle Islands where there were thousands of protesters outside and there were a good packed crowd inside. And Sean gave me a great bumper sticker that reminded me of that battle. It says, actually, it was my favorite of all the bumper stickers out there. It says, one walker beats 14 runners. So I kind of like that. But from our case, we put in place those sorts of reforms because we knew that if we were going to make the reductions in state aid to local governments, the only way to offset that was to give local governments and the state government as well the power to offset that through reform. And it certainly got the most attention because of collective bargaining, and specifically the most attention because we were able to make require public employees now going forward to make pension and health care contributions that many of them weren't making at all, in some cases at a higher level, but in many cases the local level, some of them weren't making them at all. I remember my brother, who's a banquet manager, my brother David, younger brother, great guy, he's a banquet manager, part-time bartender. His wife sells appliances at Sears. They are a typical middle-class family in our state. My brother, in the thick of this, said, I don't get why these guys are all upset. I pay $800 a month for the health insurance plan that my employer provides and the little bit I can set aside for my 401k. I'd love to have what you're offering. Because even under those changes, all we asked for was, at the state level, was our employees to match their pension contribution, just like just about every other employer that has a pension or a 401k does, if not many that don't match it at all. And we ask our employees, get this, to make a 12.8% premium contribution for the health insurance. Not exactly outrageous. Most private sector employees in our state were at a minimum matching the retirement contribution and making anywhere from 20 to 25% on average of their premium contribution for their health insurance plan. So what we were asking for in and of itself was pretty generous. And I remember my brother followed up with it. He said at his church, where they go to the church not too far from where my home is in Wauwatosa, he pointed out that at the height of this controversy early on, that a number of the public employees who were there would commiserate with fellow parishioners there and they would get a fair amount of empathy. He said by the second or third week of this, though, instead of feeling empathy, feeling that these public employees were under siege, my brother said it was interesting. By the second or third weekend, people who were public employees stopped talking about it. I said, why did that happen? He said, well, once the other church members realized how little public employees paid for their pension and health care, instead of being empathetic, they got upset. They got mad and angry and said, what are you talking about? You've got a tremendous deal even with what the governor's offering. You should be appreciative of that. More importantly, though, than the pension and the health care contributions, one of the great things that has been largely underreported, not only nationally, but even within my own state, is what we really did was much greater than just the pension and health care. It was much greater than even balancing our budgets at both the state and the local level. What we did was empower people who were duly elected at the local level to take full control of their schools, of their cities, or their towns, and we at the state level of our state, in a way that provided true, lasting, long-term, sustainable reform. Probably one of the best areas was in public education. About 3 years ago, in the spring of 2010, long before I was the governor, There was a young woman in Milwaukee named Megan Sampson who was named the Outstanding Teacher of the Year for the entire state. She was the kind of teacher that you'd want anywhere in the country, but particularly in a place like Milwaukee, which is one of these classic urban school districts that routinely is challenged time and time again. So Megan Sampson was named the Outstanding Teacher of the Year. A week or two later, she got a follow-up notice, but it wasn't about telling her when the award ceremony was. It was telling her she's being laid off. She's been laid off. Now you think, how could that happen? Well, in Wisconsin, long before I was governor, even under Democrat control with a Democrat governor and a Democrat legislature, in tough economic times, they had to make cuts to local government. That included local school districts. And so Milwaukee was one of those districts where the only option they had to balance their budget was to lay off teachers. Now, under the old system before Act 10 in Wisconsin, that meant that under collective bargaining, seniority and tenure trumped everything else. So a new teacher like Megan Sampson, who was named one of the best teachers in the entire state of Wisconsin, was one of the last hired, so she was one of the first fired. She was one of the last in, she was one of the first out. One of the great untold stories about the reforms that have a much more lasting impact than just balancing a budget is in our state, when it comes to education and everything else we do in the public sector, seniority and tenure are out. We can hire and fire based on merit. Yeah, that means we can hire and fire based on merit. We can pay based on performance. That means we can put the best and the brightest in our classrooms and in our other government positions, and we can pay them to be there. I get so frustrated when the media somehow claims that only one party cares about people when it comes to education. I said, no, one party cares about the education bureaucracy. For people like myself and others, what we care about are results in the classroom. And we should never apologize for that. So for us, it was interesting. Now, from a legal standpoint, you'll get a kick out of this. So we had an election in 2010. For the first time in many years, we swept just about everything. There was a Democrat governor, Democrat lieutenant governor, Democrat majority in the House, or lower chamber of the State Assembly, Democrat majority in the State Senate. Majority of members of the House of Representatives were Democrat. Both U.S. senators were Democrats. In 2010, like many other Midwestern states, we flipped everything. Elected me, lieutenant governor, a Republican senator, 5 of the 8 seats in the House, majority in the state assembly, majority in the state senate. And I remember about a week after the election, I came to the Capitol and talked to all the existing members of the legislature, plus all the newly elected members in their caucus. And I said, you know, the people of our state had a real choice. And on November 2nd of 2010, they chose to change everything. Not just one part or the other, not to offset one or the other. They chose to change everything. And I said, that is a great reminder to us that the reason they chose to make that difference, and even before that election, in 2009 and into the 2010 election, I had said, even though I wasn't the governor, wasn't even the nominee at that point, I had met with Paul Ryan and our legislative leaders who were then in the minority and said, we need to focus on the economic and fiscal crisis of our state and repeat a message over and over and over again at every level. That talked about those core tenets that didn't stray from that, that focused on the issues that are really relevant and important to the voters of our state, and then have an optimistic message about how we were going to go forward with that. And so when we won that election, that week after, I said to them, we need to make sure that we put in place the bold reforms that people expected when they elected new majorities in state government. We can't just nibble around the edges. If we're just a little bit less bad than the other party that was in charge before, they'll have every right to kick us out of office 2 years from now. I said, in the end, this was the line, as you can imagine, that got the headline the next day because this was an open caucus. I said, it's put up or shut up time. And what I meant by that was people elected us to make fundamental reforms. And if we just sat on our hands and hoped that we wouldn't be as bad as the party before us, people would have every right to push us out. But instead, we put in place long-standing reforms that helped us not just balance our budget, but more importantly, helped improve our economy and make the people of our state's lives better. Not by adding more government to the lives, but by getting government out of the way. That was fundamentally important. That was the core tenet behind all that we did in those first days in 2011. Now, we won the elections in 10. We won the battle with the first wave with what's now Act 10, which was at that time called the Budget Repair Bill. We ultimately won the process battle because, as you may have heard at the time, those 14 senators that left because there's a little-known provision in the Constitution. that requires a quorum in the Senate anytime you have an appropriation. So eventually what we did was work with our state senators and say, well, take the appropriation out, take the savings you can get and just leave it. Eventually, when the senators come back, you can apply that to what's needed to balance off the remainder of that year's budget deficit as well as prepare for the next one. And so we succeeded in passing that. We ultimately won in the courts multiple times already, in both the state court and ultimately in the federal court as well. And with the help of many of you here, we had a state Supreme Court election, which they tried to make de facto a way to act on Act 10 itself. And in fact, in a race that normally is supposed to be objective and nonpartisan, the opponents of our incumbent justice basically made the race about saying, if you want to repeal, they didn't say it in so many words, but basically, if you want to get rid of Act 10, you need to replace the current justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And so in every one of those battles, now legally we're through on our eighth case, we prevailed all the way through. We're confident we're going to prevail again. But it does show you that when those on the left can't win in the electoral cycle, when they can't win in the legislative battle, they keep coming back time and time and time again to the courts. Which the last thing I'll say in that regard, and then wrap it up, and we'll take some questions in a moment, is that's why for me, and I would encourage other governors in particular to take this mindset, I want to share with you just a moment or two a little bit about why we view one of my most important roles, other than maybe being the commander-in-chief of the Wisconsin National Guard, which there were times when I really was appreciative that I was commander-in-chief of the Wisconsin National Guard, but is making judicial appointments. I haven't yet made one to the Supreme Court, but we made them at the appellate court and at the circuit court level. And for us, we put in place a process. I mentioned Judge Brennan before. We put in place early in our administration a panel that Judge Brennan leads, but of really distinguished legal minds from all across the state of Wisconsin, people that have a diverse background in terms of different types of law they practice in and from different parts geographically of the state of Wisconsin, but with a similar mindset that then review applications anytime there's a judicial opening in my state. Once it's brought up there, Brian Hagedorn, my legal counsel, takes that the next step and interviews those candidates. And ultimately, I interview every one of our appointments. And they give me a list of finalists. Sometimes it could be 4, 3, 2, 1. A few cases, it's been none. Because our view is I'm not going to make an appointment unless I feel confident that he or she is someone who meets the criteria I set to be someone who sits on the bench in the state of Wisconsin. And it's three simple criteria. I want a man or woman of integrity. I want someone who is an exceptionally competent lawyer, and probably most important of all, I want someone who understands the proper role of the judiciary, which is not to make the law, but is to uphold the Constitution and to apply the laws that are duly passed and enacted by the legislature and the governor to the measures as defined by the state's Constitution and obviously to the U.S. Constitution. There are three pretty simple criteria. But what's great about that panel, we were talking about before earlier with Leo and others, is to apply that and encourage other governors in other states to do the same. Because when you have a panel like that, it's great, because it for all the political pressures, for all the lobbying and everything else out there, if you have a panel that looks at those three criteria and then uses all their expertise and narrows it down, it makes it pretty easy for me, because by the time I get to a finalist, I still want to know personality, have a little feel, have a sense for what they say and what they believe in. But it makes it nice because I'm not looking at some wide open list of judicial applicants. And as I mentioned, for us, we've been blessed in many cases with some wonderful appointments. But occasionally, we get counties where we're just not quite as satisfied. And so we either not make an appointment or sometimes we've opened things up to try and get additional applicants. Because so far, in just 2.5 or so years, we've appointed about 10% of the judiciary in the state of Wisconsin. For me, that's an important obligation on my part, not just for my tenure, but looking ahead to the future, because those judicial appointments, by and large, are going to outlast, even though I'm not term limited. I tell Tommy Thompson, he was elected 4 times. He has the record for the most times elected as governor. I have the record for the most time elected in the same term. But no matter how many terms I serve, there'll obviously be many men and women on the bench I appoint who will be there long after I'm gone. And previous governors oftentimes had a slightly different approach, including even some good Republicans who were much more interested on whether or not people could win or not. And obviously, I want people to win because it does me no good to appoint a good lawyer, man or woman of integrity, and then have them lose. But that's not my paramount concern. We will help them along the way. We want to make sure that they're in good position because we elect on the bench all the way through the Supreme Court in Wisconsin. But that's not my paramount concern. My paramount concern is to put good members of the judiciary on who understand those core principles. And that really leads me to my last point, and we'll wrap it up and take some questions. In Wisconsin, across the country, people often ask during the recall battles and the protests, because the protests were ugly. I mean, we had 100,000 people, I mentioned at some point, but it wasn't just the volume. It was as people came in from across the country, and we talk about this a lot in our book. We had death threats and protests in front of my home, not just the governor's mansion. My kids were targeted on Facebook. They were both in high school at the time. And just all sorts of ugly things for me and the members of the legislature. But in the end, it was worth it because of what we've done. And people would often ask, you know, where do you get the optimism to think that we will prevail, not just in the outcome of the vote and of Act 10, but ultimately in the recalls for me and the other state senators who were up in the state of Wisconsin. I said, it's real simple. It goes to one quick story I want to tell you, and then we'll open up to some questions. And that is, back in September of 2011, a couple days actually after the anniversary, a decade after 9/11, 2001, I got a chance to go to Philadelphia. And many of you, if not all of you, probably have been to Independence Hall, but I hadn't. I grew up in a small town. My parents, my mom worked part-time. My dad was a minister. My brother and I didn't know it at the time, but we were pretty poor. And so usually we'd go on vacation about as far as our used white and Impala station wagon would take us, and we'd turn around and come back. And so we never made it to Washington or New York or Philadelphia or anywhere like that, which is too bad because as a kid, I loved history. In fact, I may be a little bit of a geek, but I thought of our founders almost like superheroes, bigger than life. And so when I had this opportunity, the first time in my life to go to Philadelphia, I went in September 2011, and I got up early in the morning. I was there for a governor's conference. Got up early in the morning, went out with the Park Service, saw the Liberty Bell, and then went over to what was once the Pennsylvania State House. And I came in there, and, you know, thinking about these superheroes as bigger than life, I almost thought, you know, this would be like the League of Nations. You know, this would be the League of Superheroes. You know, it would just be bigger than life as well. And as I stood there in Independence Hall, and for those of you who've been there, you can relate to this. I looked at a room that's probably about a quarter of the room we're in now. And I looked at the desk, and I looked at the chairs, and it dawned on me. It dawned on me that these were ordinary people who sat in those chairs and sat behind those desks. These were ordinary people who did something quite extraordinary. You see, they didn't just risk their political careers. They didn't just risk their business ventures. These were patriots who risked their lives for the freedoms we hold dear today. One of my favorite quotes to put that in perspective was Ben Franklin at the time saying, "We should all hang together, or surely we'll hang separately." These were people who risked their lives for the freedoms we hold dear today. The reason I tell you that story is when I think about moments like that in our country's history, and I think about what it takes to get through times of crisis, be it economic or fiscal, military or spiritual, what makes me believe that we can continue to prevail, and what I believe what has made America amazing, largely the greatest country in the history of the world, has been in those times of crisis. There have been men and women of courage been willing to stand up and think more about the future of their children and their grandchildren than they think about their own political futures. For us in Wisconsin, that was one of those moments. And I know there are many more moments like that all across this country, in state houses from one end of the country to the other, and particularly, hopefully in the future, more times here in the buildings that hold our leaders in the White House and the Capitol, here in our nation's capital, that we'll hopefully have more leaders like that in the many years to come. I have every reason to believe, based upon the wonderful history of this great country and visits to places like that stop in Philadelphia, that there are many more great days to come because of the tradition of our great country and because I believe there are many more leaders like that coming again on the horizon. So thank you for the chance to share. Appreciate you being here today.
Did you want to moderate your There's a microphone. Okay. Forward, there's also one in the back. Okay. You might want to alternate the three. We've got about 8 minutes.
Okay, good. Thank you. Well, I'll start. I'll alternate. There's two mics. They tell me we'll start the one here in the front. I'll go back and forth. They got about 8 or 9 minutes, they told me, to go through, so I'll try and be quick in my response. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Governor. Do you support or oppose the McCain-Schumer so-called Gang of Eight Senate immigration bill for a path to citizenship for illegal aliens, which, of course, is amnesty?
My position on immigration is, as you might expect, broader than either that choice. And the reason I say that's not to avoid the answer. And if I was in the Senate, I don't know that I'd be inclined to vote for it. But I think the fundamental problem with immigration in America today is one that is largely overlooked here in our nation's capital, and that is we have a broken legal immigration system. We have a system that legally doesn't work for immigration in this country. It doesn't matter whether you're from Mexico or Germany or Canada or South Africa or India or anywhere else around the world. We have a system that doesn't work effectively for people who legally want to come into this country. And before we start talking about any of these other issues out here, we need to fix that system, because it's typical of Washington. They look at a symptom instead of the larger problem. The larger problem to me is that legal immigration doesn't work in this country today. And for all the people I've met over the years who've come here over many years to get in from other countries, I want to find a way to bring more people like them into America, but do so through a process that legally allows them to come in. If we fix that, it'll be easier to fix everything else.
But McCain, but McCain and Schumer would say that they want to fix the broken immigration system, but in effect, they want to do more of the same things that caused the problem in the first place.
No, I agree with that, but that's my point about, that's the difference between a governor looking at this versus a senator, a member of Congress. They focus on one aspect of the problem instead of the larger problem is you have people who yearn to come into this country, who want to come in and earn a living, live the American dream, do all the great things, but they have a system that's so broken that they either can't or it takes so many years it's almost impossible to come in. We should fix that before we start talking about anything else out there. Way in the back.
Governor, thank you. From your perspective as a working state executive, can you share with us a couple of your thoughts, given the past experience of the past few years, about the proper relationship between a sovereign power and the workers that work for it, if any, related to the unions?
Well, it goes back to the vicious cycle I was talking about, and it drives the left nuts when I bring this up, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt actually had a very similar opinion to public employee unions as I do. In fact, they even politifact me on this and found out I was right, much to their dismay. But President Roosevelt, who's not exactly a hardcore conservative, and others in similar positions in the past, understood what I tried to articulate today, and that is, who are you protecting yourselves from? The government is the people. And therefore, in fact, I remember the day I announced our measure that's now Act 10, I spoke a little bit before I went out to the public, as I meet each week with the legislative leaders in both parties. I brought the two legislative leaders in who are Democrats, told them what I was going to do, and to say their jaw hit the ground would be an understatement. And they immediately tried to talk me out of it. And the response from one of them was, and I write about this in detail in the book, but was to say, how are the employees going to, how are we going to protect public employees? And each of them had two of their staffers sitting behind them in a chair. And I went like this and pointed at both of them. And I said, well, who protects the two of them? How are they not taken advantage of? Because legislative aides in the state of Wisconsin aren't protected under collective bargaining. They're not in a union. They're not under civil service. They're at-will employees. I said, who protects them? Well, of course, they're protected because they're in an employee relationship. There wasn't a need for a union, and completely went right over their head. but I said, that's the argument. To me, I one of the things you'll find, and I talk about this as well, and some guiding principles, we learned to be principled and to be true to our principles no matter what kind of abuse or attack we got, but also to be decent about how we did it. And you'll never have, you go back in time, everything I say in one place or another is YouTubed out there somewhere. You'll never hear me say anything negative in total. I may point out some specific examples of abuse, but you won't hear me say an ill word of public servants in my state. Because of the 300,000 people that work in state and local government, in our schools, our counties, our towns, and our state government, the vast, vast majority are good, decent, hardworking public servants. And you'll never hear me say anything bad. And the great news is, and even when I go to schools now, it's interesting to see how many teachers come up to me, usually whispering, because they don't want the others to know this, but thank us for what we're doing, not because it balanced their budget, but because the good teachers know that the ones who were there before, and there weren't many, but the ones who were bad teachers were dragging the rest of them down, and now because of our reforms, those schools have gotten rid of those bad employees and instead are focusing on improving their circumstances, and they don't have to work with a union steward anymore. They can talk directly to their principal or their supervisor or others, and that's made a huge difference. Up here.
Governor, my father is a second career public school teacher, and he fought for years not to be coerced to pay agency fees. And I want to thank you personally for the example that you've set in Wisconsin. It's a real inspiration. I also want to disclose that I'm an unabashed Judge Sykes groupie, so thank you for that. I, at least to my question, I'm a public interest litigator at the Institute for Justice. And I'd like to know, as a layperson, do you think that the federal judiciary is fulfilling its duty to serve as a truly independent check on the other branches of government?
Well, I'd broaden it to say I think the federal government in general, not just the judiciary, has gone way beyond its intended scope of, certainly I invoke the 10th Amendment often when it comes to the federal government's role in terms of states, reminding us that it's not just those powers being directed to the states, but ultimately to the people. And I think time and time again, we've seen those rights taken away from the people of our states and ultimately from our country. So I wouldn't limit it to just the judiciary. I think it's true in the legislative and executive branches as well. In fact, I think in the future, one of the things I think, not only in the legal community, but I think in general, that someday people would find refreshing were leaders that would come to this city with the idea of dramatically reducing the size and scope and influence of the federal government on each of our respective lives, and instead restoring that to what our founders thought, and that being the states, but more importantly, as I mentioned, the 10th Amendment to the people.
Thank you.
You told me this is the last one, so I apologize to the other two at the mic, but way back there.
Yes, Governor, my name is Craig Richardson of Colorado, and I'm a proud member of the Douglas County Board of Education. I don't know if you remember last summer you gave us a shout-out, and that set in motion a clean sweep victory last week in which our candidates who said no to unions, yes to teacher pay for performance, and yes to optionality for parents prevailed. So thank you. As you continue to lead the education transformation movement in Wisconsin and beyond, as we saw in Colorado, what are the next steps in the area of creating a space for local school districts to continue to experiment with more choices outside the public school system that expose the public school system to competition?
Yeah, that's a great point. And you guys have been doing a little bit of this. Certainly we did statewide. Again, the untold stories of what we've done is we've empowered every one of our public schools, traditional public schools, to act more like successful charter and choice schools where they're under no limits under collective bargaining. The union contracts aren't in place anymore. It goes beyond just the seniority and tenure I talked about not being there anymore to the point that they can try, they can do different hours, they can do different days, they can do different methods. We have not limited. We had one school district that dramatically reduced the number of teachers, but gave the teachers that were left, I think it was something like a $15,000 pay raise because they wanted to pay for their top exceptional teachers and find a different model out there. We're going to watch closely to see if that works or it doesn't work. But the beauty is school boards that are duly elected by the people and not a handful of people elected by the unions are the ones who get to make that choice. And so those reforms are really important. And actually one other interesting example of that is even in terms of savings, one of the biggest abuses that showed about how corrupt collective bargaining can be is most of our school districts before our reforms had to buy their health insurance from just one company called WA Trust. Just happened to be affiliated with the teachers union. Well, after we got rid of that, they could bid out their health insurance, and it literally saved our schools tens of millions of dollars, money they could put right back into the classroom. So there's all sorts of examples like that. But what we did most recently, again, in our state, we were the original state for school choice back 23 years ago in Milwaukee. There used to be caps on that. Last budget, I lifted the caps, expanded to another school district we're seeing. But in this budget, I expanded school choice as an option all across the state of Wisconsin. And the reason I did that was not to create a separate school district, but with the simple concept that goes to the heart of your question, and that is my belief. Both my kids went to public schools. I went to public schools. I have no problem with public schools if they work. But I wanted to create an environment where every kid in my state had access to great education. No matter what their background, no matter what their zip code, no matter what their parents do for a living, every kid in our state should have access to a great education. For the vast majority of kids, that's going to be a traditional public school. For others, it's going to be a charter. For some, it's going to be a choice or a private or a voucher school. For others, a virtual, and some even a homeschool environment. For every kid in our state, there's a perfect opportunity for them. And I mentioned this recently. I was reminded of a friend of mine years ago, whose kids are about the same age as mine now, so they're all in college. But years ago, even without vouchers, they had three kids, and they sent their kids to three different schools. One was a public high school, one was a private all-boys school, one was a private all-girls school. Why? Because under their, and they had the means to do it, under their choices, they realized for each of their kids, each of those schools was the perfect fit. That's really not a stretch of a concept, because think about it. One of my sons goes to Marquette University. He's a sophomore. My other son is a freshman at the University of Wisconsin. We do it all the time when it comes to college. None of you send, well, maybe some of you do, but most people don't send all their kids to the same school they went to. But that's what we're faced with in the traditional K through 12 system. Why do we do it with higher education? We do it because every kid has a different outlook, has a different perspective, has a different need, so we find the right higher education institution for them. We should be able to do the same thing when it comes to K through 12 education. So the key, the explanation point on your question is, we expanded school choice, not so much to take kids away from the public school system, although many are, but to put the pressure on so that the public school system in our state, school district by school district, that now has the tools to operate more like successful charter and choice schools, now has the pressure to use those tools effectively, because if they don't, those parents are going to send their sons or daughters to the other successful schools in their region, and they're going to put the pressure on. What we found is school after school after school used them, but some of our bigger ones in Milwaukee and Kenosha and other places still kind of ran lockstep with the unions. And it doesn't do you any good to have those reforms if there's no pressure put on to use them effectively. And so expanding as many choices as possible in as many different formats as possible puts the pressure on every school, public or private, charter or choice or otherwise, to perform. And if they don't, the marketplace is going to allow parents to move their kids to a school that does succeed. And that's ultimately not just a moral imperative. In our state, we said increasingly it's an economic imperative, because if we show we've got a steady supply of well-trained, well-prepared workers out there, employers will want to come and grow in our state as well. So thanks, everybody. Appreciate being here.